Alrighty, so we're going to get straight into this episode of Africa State of Mind. I am excited, I'm emotional, I'm nervous at the same time. If you normally listen to this podcast, you'll know that whenever it comes to having a guest, it's so easy for me to kind of like come up with a cute kind of opening for this particular person, for the guest that I have. But for my guest today, and she's looking at me, so I can't even like look at her because I don't want to, I want to get through this without crying. So the guest on today's episode of Africa State of Mind is the person in my life that has taught me the most about pushing your dreams, and I'll explain why. I don't know if she'll remember the story, but I'll explain why. So I literally met her but I've known her for quite a long time, and she worked with me. I think she reported into me, actually, when she was a Channel O VJ, when I headed up Channel O Africa, and she had it toughest of all of the VJs. I literally think I gave her a hard time. She was an intern. You know, I remember many a times that we would get into like weird tense moments, and it was strange because we had a friendship before then, and I think a lot of times that suffered. I remember this one particular day when there was a lot of downsizing at the channel, and so we were dealing with a lot of things. I was dealing with a lot of bureaucracy at that particular time, and obviously I was not able to tell people that worked with me that this is what's happening, that's what's happening. And I was driving an old white car and I literally remember we were in Rosebank. I remember where we were, and I dropped her off, and I think that's when I told her that this was not going to be happening anymore. And then you know she had this look on her face, and then I just said to her, I said, one day I'll see your name in the stars, literally, if you remember that. So it's like, just the reason why I say she's the person who's taught me the most is that no matter who is for you or who is against you, no matter what obstacles come your way or don't go, you know, however things do and don't go, number one, she's always kept a happy disposition, which is something that you don't find from a lot of people. Number two, she is the epitome of that girl who lives her dreams. You know, number three, I don't know anybody in entertainment who has a more, who just really has such an amazing experience. Like, your experience of Africa, of the world, is beyond phenomenal, you know? And then number four, she literally is the sort of person who stumbled into what it is that she was doing and what it is that literally surged her into the next level. And she's done that because it's proof that purpose and passion always at the end of the day meet. So everybody knows her as Shoma Georgia. I was gonna try to do the rhyme, but let me not embarrass myself. You'll be like, please. You'll be like, that's not cool. You know, I know her as Miss Maya, but I'm so excited to have her on this episode of Africa State of Mind. She did a phenomenal job at the Global Citizen. She's literally living her dreams, and she never even knew that these were her dreams. And I heard a quote in an interview where she quite literally said, what was it that she said? She said something like, I don't know what people talk about when they say that being famous is not fun. This is fun, guys. I'm having a great time. And she spoke about how she was determined to enjoy her life because this was not it wasn't a preview to anything else, but this was her life.
Yeah.
She is a poet. I think it's important that people need to know that. She is an intellect, quite literally. She's a polyglot. The amount of languages she speaks is phenomenal. She is possibly one of Africa's greatest creative art heroes because from her styling and to her sound to everything that she's done, she's literally influenced an entire generation, and she's done it within the span of a year and a half, which is quite phenomenal. She shared the stages with people from Cardi B to like The Weeknd to Chris Martin to Beyonce and Jay-Z, you know. And on top of that, she has a love for the continent. So she's lived in different places. I think Senegal, if I'm not mistaken, in Tanzania, of course. We'll talk about that.
Yes.
And South Africa. And she's a rural girl who grew up not looking like everybody around her, but she's now managed to bring her entire community into the world and as part of the global stage. Shoma Josie, I'm so proud of you. Honestly.
Thank you so much. That was an amazing... So you do better intros than that for other people? That was amazing.
No, I think it was like I sat there and I just kept, you know, starting again. How can I say this? And I thought, you know what? I know you long enough that I just thought, let's just make this an open conversation.
That was amazing. Wow, Thank you. So touched. Hi. I'm so happy to be here and having this conversation. It's quite crazy how we met, and the fact that you know me in a completely different
Listen, country. I was shocked when people were talking. I said, who? What? I was like, no, it's not the same person.
I need to understand when you actually made that link. Like, this was my intern.
Yeah, it was when Luena said it.
Yeah.
Luena, she actually said, because Luena obviously worked at Mnet and everything, true, a channel as well. So she literally said, no, man, you know, my, I said, who? I said, no. Because I remember you, the cutting your hair phase,
yes,
the this, and you literally, you know what I mean? So yeah, when I saw, I was just like, what? I feel like I close my eyes and I open my eyes and yep, literally you're taking over the world.
It kind of feels that way. Yeah, it feels like it was so quick, you know, yeah, but of course it wasn't. Mm. A lot of the stuff that I did before then, I didn't know was almost leading me to do this. Mm. You know, there's some stuff that it's like, wow, that's so random. Like, mm, why were you in Senegal? You,
yeah,
know? But now it's like, here I am. And now, like, I'm French speaking, I'm Swahili speaking. Like,
right,
there really is not an African country that I cannot communicate in, except maybe a Portuguese one.
But I think you'd pick it up. I have a feeling.
I mean, yeah, it's quite similar to, yeah, to French and Spanish. So I feel like that's my passion. That's like my dream, is like to be in all over the continent. Like, that's my love, let's, mm, rather say. And that it was something random. I also have a love for African languages. And all of these things seemed random.
Yeah. And you're very smart. No, let me tell you, like, I have to just say it. I don't say it lightly. There are very few people that I call very smart. Like, I have to stop using your other name. But Shoma Jozi is literally really smart. I just remember so many times you would come up and you'd have all these ideas that were out of the box. I'm like, Thelonious who? I'm like, I remember
when I
wanted
to interview Theophilus London. Yeah,
Thelonious.
That was a hard time for me. Definitely, yeah, interning at Channel, mm, was tough for me, mm, because I think it's tough for me to be in an office environment. Mm. And I discovered that even after I finished university, it was hard for me to be in any kind of really very structured environment. Mm. Like, I find that very hard. And a lot of people are like that. So, mm, I remember in high school, literally them calling my parents and calling a whole meeting. And then the school counselor said, like, if children don't fit into the box, you have to cut their arms and legs off. Like, they literally said that, sure, you know, in a meeting with my parents. And I think a lot of creative people get stifled. A lot of creative people get that creativity beaten out of them, essentially. Mm. Because you feel wrong. You feel like, I'm a problem. Because, mm, I don't fit into these spaces, there's something wrong with me. But actually, there are other spaces in which being exactly who I am is actually a really good,
yeah,
payoff.
Yeah.
And I'm glad I didn't lose my spirit, mm, along the way, you know?
Yeah.
But now I'm in a career where being as outspoken as I am and being this talkative and wanting to live a crazy life, mm, is paying off. It's actually, yeah, it's good for what I do now.
Yeah.
I'm the luckiest in the world for that.
Yeah. And you know what I really, because what I also think that is so important about just you as a person and what you represent. You know how whenever we think about stuff and we're all like artists, we're like, this artist changed the game. And people use that term lightly, mm, but you quite literally changed the game, literally everything from your look. And I know that your hair was inspired by Tandisa and Imazwa,
yes,
you know,
yes,
but just like everything from that to your sound and mixing, you know, I'm not going to be able to say the word.
Uh-huh.
Thank you.
Every
know
time you
me,
need to say it, just points.
Just points. Yeah, because you know me, my Ugandanness is still serious. So, you know, that and Tsonga, like mixing,
yes,
that, you know what I mean? Fusing just even your look and everything. And so I kind of want to get to a place where I understand where this all came from, because I do feel that as Africans, we are a mix of so many things.
Yes.
Your mix is 100,000 times crazier than most people.
Yeah.
Because I don't know if I know many people who would say, you know, maybe it just represents the people in my circle who would say that they grew up in a rural background.
Yeah, yeah.
So how would you describe, you know, that and also just your experiences? Because I know it was a little bit tough. You didn't look like people.
Yes.
Sounds a little bit like Trevor Noah, but
yeah,
let's get into it.
I was born in Elim, and I grew up in Shirley Village right next to Elim.
Mm.
It's a small village. And when I say village, I really mean that my first home was a hut. It was,
wow,
a thatch roof. It was,
yeah,
grass roof. And I grew up just sort of, you know, in this very, very rural area. But the weird part of all of that is that my dad is white,
mm,
you know, and he was around, I mean, especially very early on in my childhood. And yet I didn't speak English. So my white father was speaking Xitsonga to me, to,
yeah,
my siblings. And so I just kind of grew up like, first feeling kind of normal, because the way a lot of villages are set up, or maybe just mine, I'm not sure, is that like everybody in the exact area was related to me. So everybody knew me and knew us. It's only when the world started becoming bigger, like when you start having to go to preschool and whatever, that you, like other things come in. And then it's like, dude, you actually like are not normal. Like you're, this is bizarre. Life is weird. I mean, I experienced it because of course my hair looked different than all my cousins and stuff, but I always, we always had braids and we lived in this kind of system where we all had to have the same braids. We all, everyone had like to be equal. Yeah, we all had to be equal if you were your age mates. So it was me, Naluva, Narandu, Natami. But Tami's a guy, so when it came to like the hair and stuff, like he didn't. So it was all my cousins that were in the same age group. And we all had to have always the same things. So your mom can't come and buy just you something. Like they have to buy for all of us.
Yeah.
And Luba can't go and do long braids if we're all doing bob braids. Like it was like to inspire this thing of like, you're all equal, right? And so my hair used to grow quite big, like, and they used to cut it because they were like, it just, it doesn't look like everyone else. So I didn't even know my hair was different because it was always short. I even burnt the side of my scalp at some point. So then I really looked like a boy at some stage. So there were little things like that, like, okay, your hair needs to be cut, or like when my cousins would call me Majosi because they were like, you're light-skinned, you look like Vivian Majosi from Generations,
crazy,
right?
Crazy, yeah.
But I just thought, like, that's me, and, like, my other cousin is Sarafina, like, it's fine, like, everyone has their own characters, you know? And I guess I kind of grew a little bit oblivious to the fact that, like, I was literally half white.
Yeah.
Because everyone around me was
protected. Yeah.
Yeah. And you also, I think you see yourself based on what's around you. You have no real concept of yourself. You just look at everyone else around you and you're like, this must be me. This is who I belong to and this is me. I remember one time looking, when we eventually moved into town, when my dad got like a better job and stuff. He got a house in Pulukwan, which was then Petersburg. And I remember walking towards this mirror at school and seeing my reflection and being like, who's that super light-skinned person? Like,
you're kidding.
Yeah. I had this weird idea of myself as being a lot darker.
Yeah.
Sure. I think it's just because that's, you know, your surroundings. I was like, oh, that's, what's that light-skinned chick? And I was like, that's me. That's my reflection. Oh, my gosh.
Like, sure.
So weird. But yeah, I would say definitely very rural upbringing. I remember, like, everything, fetching water.
I've never fetched water in my life. So this is like... And I don't want to.
I wasn't the best.
Yeah. So now let's also just fast forward just a little bit, because you grew up in a rural area.
Yeah.
And then, as you said, the world started to get bigger. Yes. Your family moved to Petersburg.
Yeah.
Right? Which is now Polokwane. And then fast track, I think when you were maybe around 16 or something, your family moved to
Tanzania.
To Tanzania, of all places, like, which is literally one of the dopest places in the world. Can we just have a moment?
Place, yes, it is the dopest place. Yeah.
So let's just talk about just then how, you know, you go into all these different countries, how that all happened. Because I know those, you were there, then there was a point you were Senegal, then you were in the States. I was like,
what? And I met you in Uganda.
Yeah, imagine. So let's...
So basically, my dad got a job offer in Tanzania.
Yeah.
But, you know, he didn't want to uproot the family and stuff. Because I had now, at this point, been uprooted quite a few times already. Mm. So I'd, like, you know, I was living in the village. And then when my parents split up, I was no longer living in my dad's house in the village. I now was living in my grandmother's house in the village. And then I moved into my dad's house. And then we moved to Pretoria. There's also like a period in which I lived in Pretoria.
Okay.
Yeah. And then...
Yeah, Pretoria is hectic.
Hey, you see. And that's the school in which I went to. And it was just a mess. Like, it literally even came out recently with the Girls High saga. But even the school that I was in, I had natural hair. I had an afro and was constantly told, like, that's against the rules and getting into trouble all the time. And then eventually that meeting that led to them saying, like, you know, if she doesn't fit into the box, we're going to have to cut her arms and legs off, right? And then that's the moment. That's literally the moment where my dad was like, actually, maybe we do need to uproot her, because actually this is not... healthy. Like, I think he also just thought I was just being difficult. But when he sat in that environment, I think he saw that actually it's not an environment for me. And that's when he said, sharp, maybe we'll try Tanzania. And the school that I went to in Tanzania, there's like no school uniform. Like, you could do whatever you wanted with your hair. And because Tanzania is so safe and so wonderful, I had complete freedom.
Yeah.
Like, it was ridiculous. It was like a 2-year vacation. Mm. It was amazing. And what a beautiful place to find yourself. So I would say that's probably the like Tanzania is where I really started to think of like who am I really?
Because I actually always just thought in my mind you were Tanzanian. That was my initial thing. I actually just thought that you were. Okay, but let me let you continue the move on to different places.
So, So while I was in Tanzania, you noticed, and especially back then, and you would know this, is that South Africa was very isolated at that time.
Mm-hmm.
In Tanzania, I never saw Black South Africans unless they were working at the embassy.
Mm-hmm.
But white South Africans you did see at that time.
Yep.
So you had basically a country that was completely isolated culturally and just didn't know about the rest of the continent. That was South Africa at that time.
Mm.
South Africa was the only country not playing Afrobeat. Mm. It was the only country. Like,
please say it again.
It was the only country at that point. Mm. Was completely, completely behind. And the rest of the continent seemed to be emerging together and falling in love with this new sound.
Mm-hmm.
And it was so exciting because that was the time when like P Square came out with their first singles. It was massive. I remember going to concerts in Tanzania.
60,000 people.
Yes. Mm. All singing. Like, if you do me, I do you. Mm. And then I'd come back here and they'd be like, what's it like in Africa? And like, P Square, what? And like, I was like, what? This is crazy. I feel like there's this whole world out there. So Tanzania didn't just show me Tanzania. Tanzania showed me Africa.
Mm.
It showed, because Tanzanians really see themselves as being a part of this continent, right? And they are so aware of themselves as being Africans and that they have neighbors and that they have this other community around them. Whereas South Africa at that time very much saw itself as being quite isolated and didn't care what was happening outside of its borders. So being in Tanzania, I was able to then travel to Kenya. I was able to travel to Uganda, which is where I met you.
Yes.
and so it exposed me to a lot more. Me and my dad even drove to Tanzania and, you know, drove through Zim, Moz, Malawi in Tanzania. And just seeing that was like, it was mind-blowing. I was like, wow, my people. Like, literally, you know, because for me already there's no distinction between, like, if you cross the South African border, if you go into Mozambique and the people there are Shangaan.
Yeah, it's the same. Like, what are we talking about these borders at the end of the day?
At the end of the day, now you're like, what? And then it just, I would say if you're going to learn more about the continent, I would recommend like going slowly bit by bit, because you see that it's like a gradient, like we're so closely related.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get to Tanzania and I'm hearing this language which I completely fell in love with, and it sounds just like Zulu. And I'm like, it's so similar to languages that I already know. So I got to kind of see as well, just by getting there I got to see a couple of countries and stuff. But yeah, to make the rest of it a bit more brief, I then went to school in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
So I studied in the U.S. for 4 years. I took a break during that time and worked at Channel O and then went back to school. And then after I finished that, my first job was in Senegal.
Mm. And what were you doing in Senegal? What was that?
So that was the time in my life that I had decided I was going to be a politician.
Okay, this I didn't know.
It's hilarious. I feel like I've lived so many lives.
Yeah.
Like, so I decided I was going to be a politician.
Yeah.
Because what happened was, basically, with the U.S. school system, there's 3 months of summer break every year. So you can actually use that time to intern.
Mm.
And I did. So the first break that I took, I came and started working at Channel O. Then I went back. Then the second one I wasn't able to come back, actually, at that time. And I was working at a restaurant in New York to make money. And then the third one, I was working at this NGO in Limpopo. The Limpopo branch of it, at the Legal Resources Center, which is my favorite organization. And once I get really balling, I really want to like help maybe be a philanthropist, because what they do is really, really amazing. So they work with people who have no access to lawyers, but they work on human rights issues.
Okay, sure.
So it won't be like if you like ran over somebody. No, it's more like people are getting evicted from their land and things like that.
Yeah.
Communities. And then I realized during that process that the biggest obstacle in the way of those amazing people doing that amazing work was literally the government.
Mm.
I never, during the land claims process, I never saw
It never once was the direct opposition to people getting their land back. Never once was it directly a white person. Mm. Never. Even if a white person was in the wrong, it was because a corrupt government official was taking a bribe to allow
it to happen.
This ZZ2 farms, for example, to steal the water from the land that was supposed to be given to X community or blah, blah, blah. It was always because a government official was standing in the way of that, taking a bribe. We were trying to help communities get land where, like, it was like a government, the government had purchased the land from the white farmers already. And then instead of giving it to the community, they were renting it out to like a company to mine it or whatever. Mm. Like, because during the process of, like, you have to evaluate that land. So you get to see if there's minerals, if there's water, etc. Now you're sitting there as a government official who has the power to give it, the land back to the community who have claimed it rightfully. And then you think, okay, maybe I can loan it out to someone. So they would get money and rent out the land. And the community sitting there, they're getting old. Some are dying before they get to see that land again. Sure. It's sitting in this government office. The paper's there saying the community can have it. But some government official is taking bribes, you know, and renting it out to whoever. And then sometimes it's like they might use up all those resources and then put black people on that land, and then then they say, "Oh, black people can't farm." But it's like you've literally drained up all the water.
Wow,
you know.
Sure.
So anyways, I realized, like, why are the good people not in government? Like, why are the good people the ones outside of government trying to fight? Mm. So I said, I'm going to be in government. Mm. That's kind of how that went. And so I was like, how does a person become, like, president? Mm. And I was like, there's all these different routes.
So you had dreams to become president?
Yeah, I was going to become president.
And I believe you can do it. I would not be surprised. Look, Donald Trump is president of America. Anything can happen.
At that time, I couldn't really figure out, like, how to do it, right? So I said, the best way is if I know how to become elected.
Mm.
So in South Africa, like, sometimes ad agencies do political campaigns.
Yeah.
So they'll come up with the slogan, the posters, etc. But in other African countries, because they don't have such a big advertising industry, they use there are political campaign agencies. Okay. This exists. But because none of them are African, you get like an American.
Oh, yeah. I've actually heard about how this happens. It happened in Nigeria just recently.
You see, yeah, so they'll come in and it's like, how can an American
give you your campaign for an
Nigeria.
African?
Like,
for
imagine.
Nigeria. Yeah. And so that's actually one of the things that people never talk about, which is why a lot of times, I mean, just to digress, a lot of times it seems like the people who are running in for, you know, office, or the people who are in power, and once they get in power, they just feel so disconnected.
Exactly.
But it's because somebody internationally has given them a strategy, which then weakens the African country, which then puts us back in a situation. But
exactly. And then that's also when, on a campaign perspective, you also see people, like, you can see an African politician being pretty much framed almost exactly like Obama or
exactly
something, which is not effective here. Which doesn't work here.
Yeah,
you have to understand locally what are people going to respond to.
Yeah.
So then the first African political campaign agency was started in Senegal, Niel it's called, and I was like, I need to work there. So I wrote to them, please can I intern. I got money, funding from my school and stuff to go. And I spent 3 months working, interning there. And we got to work on like political campaigns for like different parties in different parts of Africa. And I got to learn about that, right? So I went back to school, wrote my final, undergrad thesis, and then they offered me the job, and I was like the youngest person in that agency. And so went there, worked, and then we did a political campaign for a Tanzanian political party.
Mm-hmm.
So went back there, and obviously it helped that I spoke Swahili and everything. And it was so crazy.
Mm-hmm.
It was so
crazy. So you were in the middle of like politics in like a deep way, and yes. I don't even think you were 21 at this.
No, oh no, I might have been actually 21.
You were like 21.
Exactly 21, yeah.
And at 21, you're involved in political campaigns between Tanzania, Senegal. This is crazy.
It was hilarious.
Do you understand? Because it's like,
and they sent me first because at the time it was quite a dangerous situation for uh-huh. the candidate that we were working with because yeah. he had just left his party, and then also he was exposing a major corruption scandal in Tanzania. So his life was dangerous, and it was dangerous to be seen as working with him, right? Mm. So when I came in, I had to lie and say I was studying politics or whatever. Mm. And that's how I would find myself in these like press conferences and whatever.
This is crazy. Like, it feels like scandal. What
it was.
Yeah, it feels like.
With Olivia Pope.
With Olivia Pope. And you're 21, you're basically Olivia Pope.
It was crazy. There are times when we would be out and they'd be like, oh, such and such's assassin is here, so we gotta go. I'm like, that's how it was. The assassin, like, they were known assassins. Guys, it was insane. And that time was like, I realized, like, after a few months, I was like, I actually have no desire to do this.
Yeah.
I can't. It's too. It takes a different kind of person. And I did grow.
Somebody willing to die.
Yes, you are. You're willing. And I thought, like, wow, like, this. It was crazy. And, like, standing in front of a crowd of, like, 60,000 people and trying to talk to them, that is crazy. Singing to them, that's fine. But, like, it was insane. We were writing speeches at, like, the very last minute and, like, handing it to this guy, and he would go up, and it was, like, natural. It was beautiful. It was moving. And I was like, I don't know if I can do that. Like, just the guts of it all.
Mm.
I have a newfound respect for politicians. Whether they are good politicians or bad politicians in terms of their intentions yeah. is one thing. But the ability to do that job alone is something.
Mm.
Every day you're getting scrutinized. Every day you're getting dragged through the mud. And I would panic like, oh, this is a PR crisis right now. And our candidate was like, yeah, totally. Like, what are we going to do? Mm. Let's just come up with the plan and stuff. Because every day is that. Guys, I would have a heart attack.
So it's no wonder that you, like, now that you're in the entertainment industry, you're like, guys, this is a walk in the park, eh?
Dude!
Like, because you've seen it. And politics in Africa is
dirty.
God.
It's dirty in ways you cannot
imagine. You cannot imagine, yeah.
I remember meeting this guy that I was, like, having, like, a little, like, relationship with, right? And he goes, what do you do? And I'm like, you know what? I work, I'm working on a political campaign right now. This was a week before the elections in Tanzania.
Mm.
And he goes, oh, me too. I'm like, what? You work on political campaigns? That's crazy.
Mm.
He's like, yeah, yeah. So we're going to start today. I'm like, how you can't start the week before the elections? He's like, oh, we're just going to go and give them money. I was like, oh, okay.
That's slightly different. That's not quite what I thought. That's not what I meant. It's not at all.
Yeah. And I was at his place, and suitcases of cash would come in every day. And then at the end of that week, they went out and they just handed out stacks of cash to people to vote. And they did win the constituency. So it works, I guess.
Seriously,
I was like, what are we doing? Yeah. If people can just do this.
Yeah.
It's
you could,
dirty.
Yeah. I actually think that, you know, when we watch whatever The Fix and all of that and Game of Thrones, and we think about international politics, if somebody were to do a series of African politics,
it would be amazing.
You couldn't dream this stuff up.
No.
You couldn't.
Someone actually needs to do that. I know Netflix is like looking for content.
Yeah, because reality is stranger than fiction when it comes to African politics. But now so now you get from this fantastical world, quite literally. Because I'm just like blown away. I want you to tell me names off because I want to protect you.
Exactly,
so I don't want you to say,
exactly.
Yeah, I understand now. But now, so we get from this place, and you know, you're almost like you're dealing with crazy people, basically.
Yes.
And you have this incredible life. And then you end up, I believe it was in South Africa, and you're broke.
Yeah.
Right?
So after, after I worked at Niel, I quit my job, like pretty much
like,
on the spot.
Hey. Thank
I was
you.
Like, thanks a lot. Yeah, I'm going to try something else, I think.
You're like, this is not
this
for me.
This is a lot, you know? But I think the part that was worse than the excitement of the political campaign stuff, the worst part was having to sit in the office dealing with the other stuff. So I hate being in an office. For me, I felt like I was dying slowly.
Yeah.
Like every day I would have to go there, I'd felt like I was dying. And there was my office was like one block from the beach.
Mm.
And I was like, this is mad. Like I come in here at the best parts of sunlight, the best parts of my day
yeah.
go into like being in this room. Mm. And then I only get to go home at night. Like, so I actually miss the best part of every day. Yeah. And sit in an office, and I couldn't understand it. And of course, I had major issues with my boss because I was like, why can't I write this at home or from the beach or whatever? Yeah. And she's like, no, it has to be done in this way. And I think there is a need for rules and structure,
yeah.
You know? But I also learned that I'm not a person yeah. who can
you're
cope
just,
with
you're
that.
Just, you're just a different.
I think people that can do that are different. I yeah. feel that they, like, if you can really sit in an office every day, like the yeah. same one, I honestly think there's something remarkable about you. Like, that, I do. I honestly think it's amazing. My mom the other day was like, you know, you guys are talented because, like, my aunt is really good with her hands. Yeah. So she makes my shubela and she makes my earrings and whatever. And then obviously I'm a musician. So she was like, you guys are so gifted and, like, I can't do anything. I'm like, you are amazing. You can sit in an office every day. I was like, that's phenomenal. I can't do that. Yeah. I want to. I really want yeah. to be able to, but I can't.
Yeah.
So I quit, but I didn't want to leave Senegal yet. I still wanted to learn French. Mm. I didn't want to come back to South Africa. I had, like, kind of like a self-imposed exile. I was a bit
what
frustrated.
Was behind that self-imposed exile?
I was frustrated by South Africa. Mm. Like, I was frustrated by the lack of embracing the rest of the continent. Mm. I felt also that, like, I don't belong there anymore. I belong more in countries where, like, there's more. So if you go to, like, let's say, if you're in Kenya, right, so many Kenyans, first of all, have traveled yeah. everywhere outside. So people will get on buses now and go to wherever. And so they just have a broader perspective of the continent yeah. and you can talk about different
and
countries
a more balanced
and,
yeah
yeah whereas in South Africa it was just like what I was like what am I gonna do with the fact that I speak Swahili now like what am I gonna do with the fact that I speak French as well felt like I don't really belong anymore and there were things that frustrate me like South Africa frustrates me politically it frustrates me the inequality in South Africa really frustrates me a lot the lack of change in the so-called former Bantustans frustrates me a lot because the only thing that changed, like, in terms of where I come from was the name. They just, like, it's not a Bantustan anymore. But nothing else changed
about it. The same,
about it.
Just change the label and then that's
you
it.
You know, and people are like, people are poor and stuff. But, I mean, I'm not saying nothing at all. You know, people when people didn't have electricity and now they do. But things like running water, they don't have, you know. There's no running water. Mm. All the time growing up in post-apartheid South Africa, in post-apartheid Limpopo, where I was, you had to use a bucket at night, you know. We used long drops. You had to dig, like for a bin, you had to dig a hole in your backyard and put trash there. And it was just like, where is this government change, like why is there why are we doing everything ourselves if you want running water you have to make a borehole and dig that's how it is you know and otherwise there's going to be no water for you and nobody seems to care at all and no road or anything so I was frustrated I think about also those kind of things and then I spent time like alone in a village in Senegal called Popengin.
If it was anybody else, I'd be confused. But I understand.
There was this woman. She's actually a family friend who was like, you know, I've built this house in Popengin and you should go and stay there. And it's like kind of like an hour and a half from Dakar, which is the capital of Senegal. And this house, yeah, it was just an empty house. And she was like, you can go and live there. So I lived there for 5 months under the guise of writing a book. But what I was really doing was like really thinking about myself and like, what do I want to do? It was amazing. It was absolutely amazing. The time went so slowly.
Mm.
I'm so glad I had that.
Mm.
5 months, just me and myself. And I would walk to the beach and I would do whatever and just think. Like, you could write everything you can think of and do everything you can think of doing that day and it would still be like 11 a.m. Like, that's how slowly time went. And I really I think of that time a lot sometimes when things are hectic here. Mm. That, like, I just had this complete peace and there was nothing to worry about. There was no one stressing me. There was no one I had to answer to. There was no one I was responsible for. I was just me. And I could think, like, what do I actually want to do? And I wrote a lot during that time.
Mm.
And eventually I was like, no, I have to go back home. Mm. That was the conclusion of that. I was like, let me go back and try to establish a life of some kind. Because as much as... like, I could live as much as I would want there to live in Senegal. But I was never going to be able to...
Fully
build something. So I moved home.
Mm. And then this is where everything... I'm so sorry. Your story is, like, even better than what I imagined. And I know your story. So the fact that I'm sitting here like, oh my gosh, is Netflix going to do a film about this girl? Like, I'm going to actually pitch it. I'm telling you. I'm not even joking.
Yeah, it'll be interesting. Like, from birth, like, yeah. Why did that happen? Why did my dad literally randomly go to this village?
Meet somebody,
have unprotected sex with them. And then, like, what life is this?
Everybody, if it was anybody else's dad, that statement would be, but you've literally got the coolest dad.
Yeah, true.
Your dad is literally the coolest.
Yeah. Definitely, coolest guy. But yeah, so it is a crazy life, and I came back here and I was living with him, with my father.
So now let's talk about just identity, you know, because I mean, I could ask you 1,000 questions of, you know, this and you're broke and all of this stuff, but I think your story has been so popular, you know, people know your story so much.
Mm.
And literally, guys, if you type in Google, everything will come out. But, you know, I did want to know just other stuff that perhaps are not always, you know, shared and everything. When it comes to identity, you know, and how you've brought just a different kind of identity and created almost a new genre by fusing hip hop with
gom. My bad, I was delayed there.
Yeah, delayed. And also by rhyming in
Tsonga
and then putting it over beats.
Gom beats.
Yes, you know? And also, you know, and also when you wear the
Shivelani.
Yeah. You know, oh, this is fantastic.
Yeah.
You know. So you know, just all of that. And now it's like, you know, everywhere I go, like the other day I was at the mall and then I saw that there was like you're doing something with Edgars, right? So there was this whole thing with Edgars now where you've got a brand coming out, right? A clothing label. With One Source, you know, obviously you curated this incredible stage, you know. You also are behind your identity in a very strong way. Do you know what I mean? Like all of that. And so often we hear people saying, no, we need to find our identity. We need to, you know, there's always this like extra pressure on like, who are you? It's like, guys, I am who I am, you know?
Yeah.
And I think there was an interview where you actually said that a European never has to stand up for their culture.
Yes.
You know, but you by default, by being yourself, have managed to do that. So talk to us just about the challenges, oddly enough, in being yourself, just what you've, you know, the challenges or things that you've heard or things that people have hit you with where you're just like, really?
Yeah. All sorts of things. Yeah. All sorts. It started in the beginning, of course, just insults and criticism about wearing Shibelani and stuff. Just like all the usual jokes about Tsonga people and about Limpopo, which are so tired.
Yeah.
But then when it actually became clear that I was going to become quite popular, then those ones have become less now.
Because now I bet you many people are sitting there thinking, why didn't we do that?
Yeah, I know. So true. Yeah. So there's been a couple of challenges. And I love to focus on the good things because honestly, this journey has been amazing.
Mm.
But since we're being all open and sharing, I'll discuss for the first time some of the challenges that have come from everything. So recently, there was a whole talk show about me and whether I'm culturally appropriating Tsonga culture.
Mm.
Because I can't exactly follow the exact logic behind it. I think it was something to do with the fact that why do I speak such good English and then make Tsonga music?
Mm.
You know? Like, it's almost like I'm putting that on.
Mm.
And the reality of that situation is that are you saying that as a person, like, let's say if you're educated or if you are upper class, that you should throw away your culture? Is that the kind of argument that we're saying? Because that's actually a very dangerous thing to imply.
Perpetuate, yeah.
Yeah, because it's like, it was almost as if culture belongs to poor people. You're only African if you can't afford anything better. And that's because we don't think of ourselves highly. That's why that whole argument can exist. Imagine saying she speaks really good English, or imagine saying that, like, she went to private school or whatever, so how can she be wearing Shibelani? How can she be speaking Tsonga? You're saying that if somebody comes from an upper class background, let's say, then they should throw away their culture. Culture is for poverty. That's what that argument, I think, implies, which I obviously don't agree with. And the reality of the situation is that as Africans, we're often so split. You have to be one thing at your job, and then you're another thing when you go home. You're another thing in the village. Even in the suburbs, you can't live really like the life of an African. You're still living literally in almost like a white world. Still.
So true.
So that when you want food that is your food, you have to go to the townships. If you want traditional food, if you want to hear traditional music, you have to go to the townships or to the former homelands. That's what you're saying. So what life are we living? Whose life are we living then on a daily basis here? If, like, you have to go somewhere else for the things that are you. So I'm just saying, like, we are split in those ways. But we are also all those things. We are all those things. And for me, it's true.
And that's our power.
Exactly. And for a lot of South Africans, because we experienced this huge change, like 20 years ago or so, there's a lot of South Africans who were, like, very poor and then became wealthy. So you have some siblings were raised when the parents didn't have money, and then there's, you know, and then there is, and like, they did.
What do you mean?
Exactly. So I happened to, that happened within my lifetime, where I went from living completely in the most rural setup you can think of to then going to private school later on in my life, and even studying in the US and getting to travel and stuff. So does that mean I'm not from where I'm from? Does that mean, like, if I go to the US now, like, I should throw away my traditional attire and stuff? I think that's the thinking that led us to where we are today, which is that we don't know how to be South African. We don't know how to be African as Africans. And the only thing that's going to save us is other Africans, because they still remember how to be, right? Because Senegalese person doesn't have to dress up as Senegalese. They just are. And they wear that every day. A Nigerian person wears what they wear. They don't have to, one day now you're dressing up as yourself. Imagine yourself. You're dressing up on the one public holiday that's allowed, or you're dressing up as yourself for weddings and stuff. The rest of the time, who on earth are you? This is, like, that's the question. So I think that kind of thinking is what actually led us to be here in the first place. So that's the first challenge, like a class issue. Then there's the skin color issue.
Yeah. And this, I must think, is also something that's really challenging, especially because you're, you know, because of how you speak about the continent and everything. And then, you know, like you say, you can't ignore the fact that your dad is white, you know? So then people are kind of, so anyway, let me let you continue.
And I've never hidden that. I mean, literally, you can see
it's not
that.
Like,
I'm,
you were there busy
mixed,
finding the opposite of bleaching cream. It's like,
I'm definitely, I'm mixed. And I've said it openly, and I say it now, because I acknowledge that there is definitely privilege that comes with being mixed, like with being light skinned. And you can't deny that. It's not a coincidence that, like, so many of people that are successful in this industry are light. And it's also not a coincidence that a lot of people bleach their skin. Those things are not a coincidence. I've seen it happen where I would be treated better because of my skin color. It's literally been said to my face by many people, like, you know, hey, yellow bone, this and that, you're so beautiful. Like, I've had time. It's deep. Like, our obsession with skin color is actually so deep. I hear it almost on a daily basis. It's quite scary, actually.
I think you actually did a poem around it.
About being mixed. Oh, no. I wrote an article about being light skinned.
But there was a video I saw online where you spoke about it. This was, I think, when you were in New York. Anyway, don't worry.
I wonder which one that is, because I did Why You Talk So White. I did,
I think it was that.
It was that one. So, yeah, and it's, I can't even explain to you how deep. It's so, so deep. It's like, I'll be taking pictures with fans and they'll be like, oh, like let's say someone will be taking a picture with me and they'll be like, no, you know, the light skin one first, or, hey, you guys, like, yellow bone, you guys are the same, or... It's so, I hear it every day. Like, people are obsessed with skin color. Like,
my brother had a daughter, and I was like, oh, you know, she's light, she's beautiful, like, she's, this is good. Mm. Like, it's always this thing, like, we were scared she was going to be dark. And, like, that's so... Mm. It's
heartbreaking.
Yeah, it's devastating. Mm. Like, it's really, really, really painful. On my part, I have people saying, like, people wouldn't like my music if I wasn't light-skinned or something like that.
Mm.
And, I mean, it's hard to say in my case because... Nobody did that and failed. Like, nobody tried what I'm doing and then was rejected.
Mm.
And the one example of somebody having tried that was quite successful.
Mm.
So, like, somebody having tried something similar to what I'm doing, which was the case of FB, who did Shigubu. Massive song. None of my songs have ever been as big.
You see, I'm not even going to pretend. I have no idea who that is.
Yeah. But your listeners will. And if they don't, they can look it up. It's X-I-G-U-B-U. So she became big and she was wearing Shibelan.
Yeah.
You know? And people were very receptive to her and to that song, and she's not light skinned at all. And then we just didn't hear anything else from her. So for me, I came out with a song, and of course, when Dumi Phone came out, a lot of people didn't really know how I looked, and especially Probleme when that came out. Definitely people didn't know how I look, and that was massive. Because listen,
you don't sound like you look.
I know, yeah. People, when they met me, when people started seeing me in interviews, they were like, what? Like, we were not expecting this. Yeah. So with those first two songs, were like, the Probleme in particular made me really big in Limpopo.
Yeah.
It was not a big song elsewhere, but in Limpopo it was huge because people were hearing their language and people were enjoying that.
Yeah.
Then we did Dumi Phone, and just the audacity of what we did was so new. Because if you look at it, aside from Dumi Phone, there's only Gri, where you have a Gom song with the structure of a hip-hop song. Mm. You have 16 bars, chorus, 16 bars, chorus.
I'm not going to try those words.
We came out, we took a hip-hop structure and put it on Gom. Literally, I'm rapping all throughout Dumi Phone. From the start of when I start in Hoku, I'm rapping until literally the end of that song, you know? And so we took that, and we're even told, like, when I recorded Dumi Phone, I was told that no one's going to listen to it. It's too many words. Mm. People like sparse. I mean, you have to remember, Gom at that time was like 2 or 3 lines.
It's like a chorus, a verse.
Exactly. Like, literally, there's songs where it's like one word. Mm. Like, like, it's like
a word, a verse. Same word. Come, let's just keep it real. It was
hilarious. So I was told, like, dude, people don't like lyrics.
Yeah.
But, like, keep your lyrics to a minimum. But, you know, we ignored that. And so, like, I released Dumi Phone, and that became hugely successful before I was known. Like, I think I started becoming known, like, slightly after that. So my thing is that I think... You would honestly be very dishonest to act like light skin privilege is not a real thing.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of people find me beautiful because I'm light skin.
Mm.
A lot of people don't even know the difference between beauty and light skin. Like, just light skin itself is, it's like the same word. Yeah. Like, a person can be saying, hey, yeah, you're light, like, as a compliment. That's how messed up we have been. Mm. So that's definitely true. But then it's also true that we have completely revolutionized what was being heard. The sound itself on a technical level, we changed, right? Mm. So, like, literally that didn't exist. And now almost every Gom track has a rapper on
it. I mean, you literally started a genre.
Yeah.
Basically, with fusing. You literally started a genre.
Yeah, now everyone does that. Now it's normal. Mm. And, like, imagine, I was told, like, nah, dude, this is never going to work. Like, people don't want to hear that.
Mm.
Now... Every time, you know, it's also popular with Gom guys to put a lot of people on a song. There's always a rapper now. There's like, like people are doing bars, verses, etc. on Gom, and that wasn't happening before. Mm. So it also does have to be acknowledged that, like, I brought something avant-garde and something new.
Mm.
Where my culture is concerned.
Avant-garde.
Yes!
Yeah. When will you ever hear a
Gom
say,
avant-garde? Oh my god, I said it.
Sorry.
So we definitely did that, and then I think I have a broader
idea. A lot of people don't, and that's why they don't seem, they seem vacuous, I think, because you're just doing random stuff. Nothing that I'm doing is random. Everything that I'm trying to put together is about how would a young Black African woman look, what would she wear, how would she do her hair, etc. If there wasn't the interruption of apartheid and colonialism.
Like, this is literally how Wakanda Forever would look like.
Exactly.
I mean, see what I did there?
Exactly. Yes.
I try. No, that's true.
You get me? So, yeah. I'm trying to reimagine that, because so much of our so-called beauty and our everything of what we wear and stuff is so often it's just, honestly, just a complete removal of any any traces of being African. And I said, no, man, I want to be in the club in, like, even the braids thing was quite revolutionary.
Because you're not like, I was about to say, you're not like straightening your hair, me sitting here with a wig, like, shaming my own self. But it's like, you know, yeah, you're not... You know what I mean? And
And of course people would be like, no, come on, you'd be prettier, or you'd be more successful and stuff if you just had like straight hair and stuff. And I'm like, no, I really want to reimagine this. And like, then we do like cool braids, and we do like beaded braids, and we do whatever to be like, this is what I feel like we would look like if we weren't told that everything African is so bad.
Yeah.
You know? That's what I try and imagine. And so with everything, and that's why people can gravitate to the brand, because it feels like it's something. It feels like it's standing for something.
Yeah. I think that I actually have the word for what it is.
Okay.
I feel as though through your music, through your look, through just everything, through your mind, more than anything else, you know, you literally are reimagining Africa.
Yes.
Which I think is, you know, awesome.
Yeah. Absolutely. That's exactly what I'm doing. Yeah. And I'm taking it away from it being a show for the rest of the world, because the people who have tried to reimagine it before, I feel like they have been doing it almost as a performance to the West.
Yeah.
I'm saying this is for us, and I really don't care if you don't understand what I'm saying or whatever. Yeah. But if a girl in Shirley Village can hear herself on a song, or see herself on television and see her own culture there, then for me, I've worked. I don't care. Yeah. Like, so many artists are like, oh, how the West sees us and what. I don't care.
You're not
could
about
not
that.
Be bothered.
Yeah.
I care about how we see us. Yeah. That's what I tried to reimagine.
I could have asked you 100,000 questions, literally. But I feel that a lot of the questions have been asked. And I said it at the beginning of the interview about how I could have said all these different things. You know, I did name drop for you a little bit.
Yay.
But I know that that's not even what you're really about, you know. And I think that the powerful thing is that the people that we name drop are probably name dropping you. But it's because you're that, you know, you're like a standout, almost, I don't want to say feature, but it's very clear that you represent an era all around, you know.
Yeah, I'm so excited.
I just want to congratulate you on everything, quite literally. And I love the fact above everything is that no matter how life has hit you, I said at the beginning, and who has been horrible to you, even I can attest to being horrible to you at times. Sure, she did not like me often. I can attest to being horrible at times. Thank you, producer. You know, you've just actually just kept at it. You just kept at who you are. So I think that is amazing. So I was going to wrap this up, but my producer has asked me questions. So I need to find out about Global Citizen in New York. New York. And where you were, where you got that call. And then Global Citizen in... Because I saw when you were sitting with Chris Martin, you were just like...
Yeah.
When he said your name, you were like... You literally kept on putting your hands in you're like, when they're mentioning names, you're like, he's like, Shoma Jones, you're like, oh, what? Chris Martin. You know what I mean?
He's like, Beyonce, I'm like, what?
You're like, Beyonce,
I didn't know who was on the lineup, obviously.
Oh, so you found out during that
clip? They were like, are you ready? I was like, just give me the script and stuff. They were like, oh, okay, it's just a few artists, like Beyonce, are you mad?
Yeah.
This is insane.
Yeah.
So that whole thing was like, Chris Martin wrote me an email and said, like, I'm a huge fan of music.
Please just wait. Moment of silence.
I don't even know how he got my email.
You're ruining this moment. Okay, so say it again.
I honestly, to this day, where did he get it?
Again.
Chris Martin sent me an email.
Okay.
And then, you're crazy.
Thank you. My life means nothing.
I honestly, honestly, but I did not think of it like that. I thought it's probably his PA or somebody or whatever. He goes, I love your music and we're thinking of doing a Global Citizen in Joburg and I want you to be part of it. Me personally, I want you to be a part of it. He's like, I think you're exciting. But you have to understand, this was also before, this was early on in the year.
Yeah, because you've not been around technically that long.
And also, Huku really elevated me.
Yeah, and you didn't have a project out.
I didn't even have Huku out yet at that point.
Wow.
So it was crazy for him to believe in me to that degree. Mm. And then I was like, they're probably just sending this to everyone. Let me go and stuff. Then
wait, so because I need to just try see if this ever happens to me in my life. Yeah. Like if, you know, one of the Obama sends me an email, how do I respond? So you get the mail, Chris Martin, it has his name there as sender.
Yes.
Just to understand.
Yes, and it's his email and it's signed Chris.
Please, can we end this interview?
And I'm thinking, no, someone is just saying this and stuff. And then we didn't really respond to the first one. And then they sent a second email. Now it was like his PA was like, yo, what did she say? She was like, we want to shoot the announcement video, but you have to keep this a secret. You can't talk about this, blah, blah, blah. They're like, come and meet us at FNB. So I came there dressed super casual, thinking all the artists are going to come and meet there, whatever. It was just me and Chris Martin. I remember like walking down to the field itself and he was like maybe 10 meters away and then he sees me and he starts running towards me. He's like, show! And I'm like, what is happening now? And then he's like, I am a big fan of your music. I love Do Me High Phone. I was like, friend, what are you saying now? How is this? First of all, where is everyone? I said to the PA when I got there, I was like, where is everyone? Yeah. He was like, oh, Chris is down there. I'm like, and everyone else? They're like, no, he wanted to do the announcement with you. And I was like, this is crazy. And if I'm being punked, it's not even going to be funny anymore because I'm going to be very upset. And it's going to be very embarrassing. I was like, just tell me now if I'm being punked for real now. Like, I actually said that. Mm. And then he was like, no, I love your music. And I'm like, how do you even know Do Me a Phone? Like, what are you talking about? And he says, dude, why wouldn't I know that we use the same internet? I was like, okay, good point. So we shoot that. And immediately after we shoot that, he goes, do you want to make a song together? I'm like, yeah. He's like, do you have somewhere we can record? I'm like, yeah, my place. And then...
at your home studio?
Yeah. And then he comes through and stuff. So that was like that. And then after that, I had to keep it a secret for like months, right? But I knew I was going to be performing there. Mm. And then eventually it was announced and then that was exciting.
Yeah.
And then I went to Afropunk in New York. But when I was there, everyone was talking about Global Citizen New York.
Yeah.
Because Cardi B was going to be there. The Weeknd was going to be there. And I'm like, what? I want to be there, you know? So at that point, I had no manager. I was managing myself, for most of this year. And so I'm like, no, man, this is ridiculous. How can I do this? So then I just decided to ask them, like, can I perform at Global Citizen New York? Literally, I just was like, can I? And they were like, no, are you mad? Like, you can't. Are you insane? They're like, it's way too late for that. I was there in August and it was in September, the Global Citizen. And you know how they plan it.
Like, yeah, they plan.
Really crazy. Yeah. So they were like, you're dreaming. You're insane. That's never going to happen. And I was like, yeah, but I just feel like if you guys are really serious about being Global Citizens, you would include an African on the lineup because we're Global Citizens too. Mm. And it's like, you can't just say we're only Global Citizens. We're only part of Global Citizen when it's in Africa, but then the rest of the time, no. And I'm like, you're going to fly Americans to Joburg, but you're not flying any Africans to New York, but you're saying Global Citizen and everyone is equal. So I said, if you're really about that, then you would have an African on the lineup. And they did not respond to me for 2 weeks. And I was like, wow, I've jeopardized my whole life. Like, I was like they're probably going to remove me from the lineup in Joburg as well. They're probably talking about like, wow, she's so rude and whatever. Then after 2 weeks, they sent me a message saying, hey, a spot opened up. Would you like to come to Global Citizen New York?
That's crazy.
Yes, that's how I got into that one.
Sure. And then just in closing, I keep on wanting to say your government name. And
Don't.
Now your publicist has walked in. She's going to be like, don't be messing with her brand. Seriously. So when you think, and you're probably one of the people who can just articulate this in such an amazing way. I'm laying the pressure ahead of time. I'll say pressure.
I love pressure.
You know, when you think of the statement Africa state of mind, how would you define that?
Oh my gosh. For me, I'm hoping that it becomes kind of what I'm feeling right now, which is a sense of celebration. I feel that right now Africa is the it girl, like, we are very soon gonna become the most popular girl in school. And I wish that Africans were in that mindset of knowing that as well. That's what I want the African state of mind to be. To be that, one, we're not only just equal to and deserving of being on global platforms and being in the global discussion. Right now we're leading it. So I want us to act like that as well. You know, I don't necessarily celebrate when like a Drake or somebody makes an Afrobeat song. That's not necessarily something to celebrate. I celebrate when a WizKid gets onto the platform of, let's say, a Drake.
Nice.
You know, it's better for, if the world is going to embrace our culture and our sounds, they must embrace the people making it. Love they mustn't it. Just take. And then we're sitting there like, yay, wow, they've acknowledged us, but then we're poor.
I love that. And then one other secret. Sorry, I keep on saying one other, but just tell in closing, and this is the part where the credits would roll.
Okay.
So you thought that you... Okay, I don't want to say you thought, but you lied about being the captain of Banyana Banyana.
Oh my God!
You're wearing these soccer socks? Really?
Yes,
I'm going to cut off your arms. Put you in a box.
Like, I literally I was literally, because people before,
and just to put in context for people outside of SA, Banyana Banyana is the female football team.
Yes, it's our national football team.
Okay,
the women's squad.
Yeah.
And because like when I was starting to be famous, but people didn't really know me, they were like, you look kind of familiar. So I used to make up the stuff like, oh, I'm a this and I'm a jazz musician or I'm a whatever. I would make stuff up. And one time I told this guy like, no, I'm the captain of Banyana Banyana. And he looked at my legs as if my legs were going to prove it somehow. Yeah. And he was like, psh, no, you're not. So then I got soccer socks and I started wearing them to be like, I am that. Yeah. And now I wear them all the time on stage.
Fantastical. Fantastical.
Yay. Thank you, Lee. We didn't even sort of talk about really how we met.
Uganda. I've never let anybody close the podcast.
Yes.
The episode, so I'm going to allow you to close it.
Because usually when, like at the end of interviews, people will kind of say like, what advice would you give, right? Yeah. So the first bit of advice comes from the Global Citizen story, which is just ask for stuff. Yeah. Like go for it.
Yeah.
Just go for it. You just don't know. And what's the worst that could happen, right? So that's the first bit. And the second bit I would say is be kind to people, even if you don't know them.
Yeah.
Because when I was in Uganda and I was partying with my crazy friends and it was New Year's Eve.
Yeah.
And we were going to a penthouse party at the top floor of this hotel.
Yeah.
Lee, I'm dying. So we go in there, we're excited, and it's like very close to being midnight and it's New Year's Eve. So then I see this chick sitting at the bottom floor in the foyer and seeming a little bit annoyed, looking at her phone and just like, ah, what's happening? So I go up to her and I don't know this person at all. Yeah. And my friends are like, what are you doing? I'm just like, no, let me talk to her. So I go to her and I'm like, dude, come to our party. She goes, no, I'm waiting for my cousin. And we go upstairs and we get to that party. She's like, this is the party that I was actually supposed to go to. And that person turned out to be Lee Kasumba.
Yeah.
I mean,
crazy.
At that time, I mean, like I had no idea. And then it ended up having such a significant impact in my life years later.
Yeah.
Like that small gesture
you would have thought, ah, nothing came of that. Years later, that came back around and meant the world to me. It, like, came at a time when I really needed something. Like, my dad was, like, kicking me out of the house, like, hey, if you don't want to study, like, you can move out. And I needed something. And that's when I saw you again in Tanzania. And you were like, dude, we met that time. And you remembered that. And then that's how I got to get like a couple of opportunities that have like meant the world for me at that time and also learned so much during that time. So yeah, I would say be kind to people.
My heart is so full now. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
And I really hope that Netflix, and sorry, I'm very emotional. Like now I actually literally want to cry. Oh. And it's so weird because I am good at making people cry. And twice in this interview, I've wanted to cry. So, but yeah, I think it's because I'm just genuinely just like, oh, man, your life is just an inspiration, honestly speaking.
Thank you so much.
So yeah, when Netflix, you know.
What makes the story of my life?
What, and you will be the person saying, listen, I'm telling my story. Please move. But congratulations on everything.
Thank you.
I know that it's been a crazy almost year and a half. So I can only imagine what the next year and a half can be. And just in like actual closing, I was watching a Cardi B interview today. And I thought of you, because Cardi B in the interview, she kept on saying about how people kept on thinking that she was not going to be there. She was not going to be there. It's like, oh, you've just been lucky and all of this stuff. And she was so different. And, you know, in the interview, they spoke about how it was her personality and the person that she is that has made so many more people gravitate to her. And I feel like you're exactly like that. Like your personality is so genuine that people gravitate towards you. You know what I mean? And you're literally always happy. Ask me. It's like she is always happy, you know, and everything. And I think that in the beginning, many people were thinking like, oh, this is a great, it's coming and going. Do you know what I mean? But I love
proving people wrong. And I love being the underdog,
you know, and it's like you've come and you've not gone. On top of that, you've achieved what people who've been in the industry for a very long time could have only dreamt to achieve. And the best part about it is that you've achieved that being yourself. And in that, you've literally created this era in culture, which is so important. You've created this new genre and this era and turning point in music, and it's really good to see that you are really reaping the benefits of that. So congratulations on everything.
Thank you so much.
Yay.
It's an African state of mind.
Africa State of Mind with Lee Kasumba. Get it on iTunes now.